welcome to The Bunker, your need to know on news and politics 5 days a week. The scale and abject misery of the housing crisis is now an election issue. But there is one aspect of it that, if I'm completely honest, I had not expected to make headlines in the way that it has. And that's the vexed question of leasehold. The Grenfell Tower fire sparked a building safety crisis, leaving leaseholders trapped in homes that became worthless and uninsurable overnight. They also faced impossibly high service charges for improvement bills. Now leasehold is an issue that's captured the public attention too, and the government has been forced into some action. One of the most active campaigners on this issue has been the Labour MP Barry Gardner, and he's here with me today. Hi, Barry.
Hi, good to be with you.
So you've recently fronted a documentary looking at leasehold and how it can turn the kind of dream, I suppose, as we call it, of home ownership into a nightmare overnight. How have leaseholders become trapped in their properties?
Well, look, in a great many ways, really. But Grenfell highlighted it because after that, people started looking at cladding, obviously, and was their building one that had this combustible cladding? And then, of course, they found it wasn't just about cladding. It was about all sorts of fire defects or fire safety defects. So you could have compartmentation defects, you could have fire-stopping defects, you could have faulty fire doors. So all different ways in which people found that the homes they were living in were simply unsafe. So the government, after many years of argy-barging about who was going to pay for the cladding, who was going to pay for the remediation of these buildings, passed the Building Safety Act. The Building Safety Act just made it worse because it said that you had to get an EWS1 form, that's an external wall safety form.
And that's by an external consultant, so that's more money being spent.
More money being spent, but of course, very few external consultants, very few people qualified to do it, and therefore very difficult to get one in the first place. And of course, in the meantime, your insurance payments have rocketed because they know you don't have one, so they can charge you more for the insurance. And then if you wanted to get a new job and move to a different part of the city or move to a different city, you can't because nobody's going to buy your flat.
Because you can't insure it, you can't mortgage it.
You won't get a mortgage on it. The mortgage companies, all the banks and the building societies, they don't lend on it because they say, well, I'm sorry, we're not prepared to take on that risk. And it's just been a nightmare for people because they've not been able to move. They've, in many cases, being squished into a one-bedroom apartment. They can't have more children. They can't move. They can't get on with their lives. So it's been really, really hard. And we're talking 5 million leaseholders in flats in this country. I should emphasize, it's not just flats because there are developers who have been building leasehold houses. Now you think, why do you need to build a leasehold house? The answer is so you can screw people for the revenue that you can take out of them in the process, whether that's ground rent or whether that's a service charge, not for the common parts of the house, because there aren't any, which, you know, that's what you'd be charged for in a leasehold apartment. But actually, it's charging you for the management of the estate. So the scrubby bit of ground that might be around your estate is being maintained, and they will charge you for the maintenance of that. The road will not have been adopted by the local authority, and suddenly you find that you're paying for the upkeep of the road. The trouble is, we've heard so many of these stories, many of the owners have, you know, not realized they were buying a leasehold house. They just thought, this is how you buy a house. You know, it's a house. It's marketed as a house. You go in there, you buy it. And then when you turn up...
And if you're a first-time buyer, why would you know?
Why would you know? And so people have actually gone in at the point of signing the contracts only to be told, and of course it's leasehold. Okay.
And then they find themselves stuck. I mean, you mentioned that the government has accepted responsibility for paying for some of the cladding remediation on flats, but the service charges and ground rent.
They've said that the responsibility actually lies with the developers. So they haven't actually taken responsibility. They've set up the Building Safety Fund, and people can apply to the Building Safety Fund to help them do it.
Yeah. So to prevent it being passed down to the leaseholder, in theory.
In theory.
But there are more leaseholders than just live in properties with cladding and building safety issues. And for they report that across the board, service charges, ground rents have been spiralling. What excuse is there for that, as far as you're aware?
Oh, well, there's no excuse. You mean what phony
reason.
Justification do they put on for it? Look, we've had cases where ground rent starts off, you know, it might start off £750 a year. And people think, yeah, okay, well, I can manage that. But what they don't realize is that it doubles every few years, because that's in the small print. And we have instances where people are paying £33,000 a year in ground rent. It's just
on top of their mortgage.
On top of their mortgage.
Yeah,
it is absolutely wicked what's going on. And, you know, the government still has not said that they are going to abolish forfeiture. We've been pushing them. You know, this bill that's gone through or going through Parliament at the moment. This is the leasehold and freehold reform bill, they call it. It's in with the Lords at the moment. We've finished all the stages in the Commons. And after the committee stage, quite honestly, I was fairly optimistic that the minister would come back at report stage into the chamber and say, okay, we are now introducing some of the amendments that, you know, Matt Pennycook and I had put down in the committee. But they didn't. And if you think that it is still in this country the case that you can owe 700 quid in service charge to your landlord, and you might be refusing to pay that service charge because you didn't get the service. And so you're in dispute. The landlord can actually, you can forfeit your house to the landlord. The landlord can claim your house.
They can take your home from you.
And they have the right then to sell that home. Now, let's say it's worth £350,000, okay? Do they have to give you the £349,300 back? No. They keep the lot. You owe them £700,000. They take £350,000.
You lose your entire asset.
And we said, look, there are small claims courts. Why can, if you own, you know, if you owe less than £10,000, whether it's a legitimate cost that you're bearing or an illegitimate one, if there's a dispute about anything up to £10,000, you can go to the small claims court. So why do we have this just antediluvian law on our statute books that allows the landlord to take the property?
And is there any sign that amendment will make it through in the Lords process?
Well, as I say, I was hopeful that they would bring it back in the Commons, but they haven't. And that sort of indicates that they're just digging their heels in.
You mentioned that you may be in dispute as a leaseholder over a service that you feel you haven't received. In your documentary, you met some people living in awful conditions with leaks and basically unlivable homes as well on top of this. What kind of things did you witness? What were people saying about their experience of being trapped in that way?
Well, look, the normal experience of people living in apartments where they've got disputes with their landlords would be, okay, there's mold, there's problems like that. No, we were talking about roofs that were simply unsound. The water coming through the building, I had one woman who, she videoed the water dripping down on her light fitting. So it was coming through the electrical system. So dangerous, it actually came out of the sockets by her children's bed.
Terrifying.
There were I mean, just all sorts of problems. People who lived in the middle of a building site, quite honestly. Walkways which were between one block in a development and another, with no sides, children playing where they could fall to their death. Complete lack of care.
So that money's going out on service charges and ground rent, and in return, absolutely no service at all.
Yeah, faulty lifts, faults on the fire system that are never rectified. So there are huge problems with this whole form of tenure, and we just need people to have the right to manage their own building, their own block themselves. And that was one of the amendments that we put forward to increase the threshold there so that people could manage their block themselves, because it's limited at the moment. And to make it possible for ultimately for people to enfranchise and control their lives.
And it is their lives, isn't it? When you describe it, it's obviously this is a financial crisis for very many residents, but it strikes me that it must also be a mental health crisis, because you're living in these conditions. It's very tricky to move on with your life.
No, I know of people who've committed suicide. I one very brave and feisty woman who has really fought this for years in her own block, and she's been brilliant. She was the sort of lead of the Residents Association campaigning for this, and her mental health has suffered so badly. You see the way in which the stress gets to people, and some cases people might have bought those apartments to rent out, so it was a retirement income, you know, and it's turned into a nightmare. Sometimes people buy it because they think it's great, I'm finally going to be secure, I'm going to have a home of my own, and they find that actually it's just turned into a complete nightmare for them financially and in every other aspect of their lives.
In the documentary, you met Peter Apps, the journalist who has actually been on this show a few times. He's the author of Show Me the Bodies about Grenfell Fire. He used an interesting phrase, I thought. He described how the kind of urgent and crucial response to the safety issues that the Grenfell Fire showed created what he described as a Wild West industry, which was profiting from the chaos, he said. Why has that been allowed to happen? And what do you think the government should do to intervene on that? Because essential, of course, that there is an urgent response to secure people's health and safety, but the result seems perverse.
Well, look, I right at the beginning of this, just after Grenfell, and when it had become apparent that this was a widespread problem of more than cladding, I remember saying in Parliament to the minister that what he needed to do was to introduce a windfall tax on the industry and get this done. Mm. So wherever there was cladding, wherever there were fire safety defects, then the work should be done, paid for by a central fund, which was funded by the industry. The difficulty has been that the government didn't want to do that. They have charged industry a certain amount, but not enough to cover it. And what they've done is they've put the responsibility back on the developer. Now, in many, many cases, the developer no longer exists. The developer has sold, sold, sold. So you might be three stages down the line. And of course, it doesn't mean the beneficial owner has changed. It simply means that the registered limited company.
So it's hard to find who really is benefiting.
It's extremely difficult to find who the beneficial owner is.
Is that quite deliberate, you think?
Oh, well, you may say that. I couldn't possibly comment, at least not if I were referring to a specific individual.
Sure.
But of course it is. Look, they know exactly what they're doing. We had one situation, I said situation because it's the Avon Group, and they used to contract out to their managing agents and the people who did the work on the block. And they always used to claim that, of course, they were entirely independent of each other. And of course, they may well have been, but they did have the same registered address at Company's House. And, you know, I've asked the minister in the debate that we had in committee, I said, how do you have any ability to get this done when you write to the managing agent? The managing agent says, yes, we've received your letter about doing the remediation work. We have notified our client, the owner of the building, and we're awaiting a response.
Never hear from them again.
And you never hear from them again.
Labour has pledged to end leasehold.
Yes.
What does that mean in practice?
It means for apartments moving to a system of common hold, whereby everybody who is a resident in the block would own their apartment and they would own a share in the common hold company that managed and owned the common parts of the building. So they would be in total control of their homes.
Which sounds great, but presumably that's only going to be possible on new developments.
No.
How is it possible to convert when you've got such vested interest as you've described? What process, what mechanism can there be for taking back that asset? How complex is that?
There is a process of enfranchisement that already exists, and that means that you can buy an extension at the moment to your lease, or you can buy your lease, buy out the freehold. That needs to be made simpler. In order to do that. And in fact, one of the good things about this bill that the government is putting through is that they are seeking to get rid of marriage value in that, which is basically the additional value that used to be claimed by the freeholder for the fact that it is you, the tenant, that is buying the flat. Because, of course, if you've lived in a place for 10 years, and you've got a lease perhaps that goes for, originally it might have been for 99 years. Let's say you've been living in it for 10 years, maybe 20 years, but the lease has now fallen to 50 years. It's very difficult to sell at that point because nobody wants to buy something with a short lease. So you then have to enfranchise. And if you want to buy out the freehold interest, if you want to do that as a block, you would then have to be able to take on the freehold, but without this additional incubus of marriage value.
Currently, under current law, there's a large cost to that. If you buy your freehold, it costs a lot of money. It's almost like buying an extra portion of a property. If you're ending leasehold, surely the moral view should be that you've already purchased this property at $350,000 or whatever. You should have the right to that property in its entirety.
Well, you're right. The difference between a flat with a share of freehold and a flat that is a leasehold flat, when you buy it, there isn't any. There's no difference because the market doesn't really recognize that difference. And that's why having to pay for something twice over, because if you keep on having to extend your lease or enfranchise, you are keeping on paying for the asset that you think you've already paid for. What you do is you don't actually own the asset. All you own is the right to live there under leasehold, and you own that only for a specific period of time. So we need to make it possible for you to have what you think you bought in the first place. You've paid full value of it. You shouldn't have to be financially inconvenienced to actually have what anybody else thinks is the rights of ownership.
What about shared ownership? Because the relationship there where a housing association owns part of the property and the shared owner owns part means that even if common hold is passed through, there will be this form of leasehold which will still continue. You can't really get rid of it when you co-own your property with an organisation. But I think there are a lot of people who are very worried about that arrangement, and shared ownership at the moment is a very unaffordable form of affordable housing, ironically, because mortgages have gone up, the rent on the portion they don't own has gone up, and service charges have gone up too. So what would you say to people who are trapped in that quite unique situation?
Well, of course, I'd say wind back a few years and don't do it.
I know. Well, I would say
just
that too.
Don't do it. Shared ownership is a terrible trap. And so many people think, oh, well, at least it enables me to get my foot on the housing ladder. It really doesn't. It complicates your life. You end up paying rent as well as mortgage, as well as service charge. And it doesn't work out cheaper. It works out a lot more expensive.
Is there anything that your legal amendments could do for those people, do you think?
We need to try and make it possible for people on shared ownership to buy out their freehold if that is what they want to do. That would be if they are with social housing providers, which is how shared ownership comes about. It's usually a housing association that will allow you to purchase a part of the property. Now, if you can buy out that, and that is normally the objective that shared owners go in with, they think, well, I can't afford it now, but it gives me the ability down the line. Very often they find it doesn't, because their circumstances don't change that much. And it's difficult to sell because it's a much more complicated structure. There are fewer people who want to buy 40% of a property.
And you can only buy at the portion that you own. Yes. So if you staircase up to 60%, you're pricing even more people out of it.
That's right. So people who want to buy shared ownership properties want to do that because they can't afford to buy the full property. Mm. So if you've got more of the percentage of the freehold, as it were, then you have fewer buyers wanting to buy it from you when you need to move on. Mm-hmm. So it really is a nightmare. And I, quite honestly, Hannah, I don't know how we're going to deal with that. There are some very clever lawyers out there, and I'm sure that there are ways of doing this, but we need to be working with those social housing providers to see how we can get around the problem. Mm-hmm.
So you pointed out that there have been 30 bills related to leasehold going through parliamentary process in the last two centuries. Only two have ever made it into law. Are you confident that given the clear vested interest in the system as it sticks now, that Labour can actually make something happen?
Of course we can, and we've said we will. I remember last time, though, because I was campaigning for the 2002 Leasehold Reform Act, Commonhold and Leasehold Reform Act. That was very much a sort of bill that I pushed for then. And I was disappointed then because the Lords pushed back. Mm. And they said, and of course, in those days, we had the 800 hereditary peers who were still members of the House of Lords. Now, they never came in, except when it was a property issue, a land issue, and they all trooped in to block the leasehold bill. And that's why I'm a little more optimistic. We have actually...
Things have changed.
Well, but they've...
Somewhat.
Yeah, there are still far too many people in the House of Lords who have as their register of interest saying that they derive their income from the management of land. You do still have those great estates represented there. But I am hopeful that a Labour government will see this as part of modernising Britain. We cannot go on with a feudal system of home ownership. You know, we exported leasehold all around the world. Every other country that we exported it to has got rid of it. We can do the same.
Thank you, Barry. We've put a link to the documentary in the show notes, so please have a watch. It's just 40 minutes and a really powerful summary of the extent of this problem. If you enjoyed this episode of The Bunker, then please consider supporting us on Patreon. For the same price as a cup of coffee, or frankly less if you're not in London, then you can listen to the show without ads plus a lot of extra benefits. I'm Hannah Fern, and thanks for listening to The Bunker.
Hello, I'm Roz Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was written and presented by Hannah Fearn. The producer was Chris Jones, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, the group editor is Andrew Harrison, with music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by James Parrott. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.